his palm. They disappeared into his pocket. When he pulled his hand out again, he had a knife. Joan's breath caught. "I told you," Nick said. "I won't kill you here." "You should," Joan whispered. Nick tilted his head. "I'm going to come after you," Joan promised. "I'm going to stop you from killing anyone else. I'm going to kill you." She'd never imagined she'd say those words to anyone, let alone Nick. She'd never imagined they could be true. She felt as though she was squeezing her own heart in her fist. Nick's hand tightened for a moment over Joan's wrists. Then he released her, slowly. He stood, knife ready if she attacked. When she didn't, he stepped back. Joan gripped the edge of the table so that she wouldn't be tempted to try anything now. "I mean it," she said. "You're dead." He gave her his familiar solemn smile, the one that he'd given her all the time at the house. "Aren't we all?" he said. "Somewhere on the timeline." Chapter 14. Joan ran back to the monster street. She wiped angrily at her face as she did. She hated that she was crying. Being that close to Nick had brought it all back, all the feelings she'd had for him, maybe still had for him. And in turn, he'd told her the truth in that clear-eyed way he had. He'd have killed her family even if he'd known who they were to her. He'd have killed her if the cameras hadn't been there today. To him, she was a monster, and he'd been born to kill monsters. And Joan was terrified, too. Her mind kept throwing up images of Ruth and Aaron dead in the flat, of everyone on that monster street lying dead, just like at Holland House. She made herself take the long way, though, down side alleys and doubling back, rather than running straight to the flat like she wanted to. She wasn't going to lead Nick to anyone. For the first time, she looked for cameras, avoiding them like Aaron always did. Nick had pointed out the cameras in the cafe, and Joan was sure that was how he'd found her. She was beginning to understand why monsters hated cameras. If your enemies could travel in time, you never wanted to leave a record of where you'd been. The market was bustling with people. Joan wanted to scream at them, "The hero is here in this time!" But she'd have sounded mad, like screaming that Superman was here. She stumbled up the wrought iron staircase to the landing. To her relief, she could hear Ruth and Aaron arguing through the door of the flat. "The only family without allies," Aaron was saying. "That's how much you're despised." Joan pounded on the door and Ruth opened it mid-sentence. "I don't know what the Tawalis see in your family," Ruth said. "They're too..." "Stop," Joan said. She'd had it with their fighting. She slammed the door behind her and took a deep breath. "We have to stop this," she said. "Nick is here." They stared at her, not frightened, but confused. "What do you mean?" Aaron said. "Nick is here," Joan said. "He's here in this time." There was a longer silence. "He can't be," Aaron said. "He's human. I saw him with my own power." "Humans can't travel," Ruth said. "I don't know how he got here," Joan said impatiently, "but I'm telling you, he's here." "Are you sure?" Aaron said. "Are you sure it was him?" "He took the necklace," Joan said. Aaron looked at Joan's bare throat and went pale. "Why would he do that?" Joan could guess why. Sometimes it felt as though she knew Nick as well as she knew herself. He was going to use the necklace to get to the monster court, to get to the same device that they were after. He was going to change the timeline. Aaron had said it last night. The human hero is the end of days for monsters. "You told us the myth," Joan said to Aaron. "You said that in the end of days, the hero kills the ancestor of monsters." Nick's plan was as clear to Joan as if he'd told her himself. He was going to use that device to change the timeline. He was going to kill that ancestral monster. And when he did, no other monster would ever be born. Every monster would be erased from the timeline. Nick's purpose as the hero would be fulfilled. Aaron didn't say anything, but Joan had seen that expression on his face before. He'd had it in the maze when he'd looked down and seen the symbol of the hero on the back of a man's neck. No, Ruth shook her head. She didn't want to believe it. Joan knew that feeling well. Gran told me about the hero that night, Joan said. Ruth, she knew about him. She was expecting him, but... She remembered what Gran had said. I was supposed to have so much more time to prepare you. I thought I'd be fighting beside you. I think he came at the wrong time. She wasn't ready for him. She tried to tell me more, but she was too weak. She gave me the necklace, and now Nick has it. We have to stop him. We have to. What are we supposed to do? Aaron said. If he can travel, he's probably left this time already. We know where he's going, Joan said. We know what he wants. We just have to get there first. The monster caught. Aaron breathed it out like a fearful prayer. He looked toward the windows. The middle two were cracked open, allowing glimpses of white sky amid the rippling blue of the stained glass. Listen, he said. If you're right, then every monster is in danger. We need to trust the court to stop him. I think it's time to seek an audience. Don't be a fool, Ruth spat. I realize that you're an Oliver, so your instinct is to lick boots. But the court can't be trusted. Court guards have been hunting down survivors of the massacre, and you know as well as I do that only the court can have altered the family records to conceal what the hero has done. Aaron had glared at lick boots, but now he started to frown. I can't make sense of it. Isn't it obvious? Ruth said. This is the king's timeline. Every event is how he wishes it to be, or so the court says. The king protects us from humans discovering us, or so the court says. You're perilously close to blasphemy, Aaron said. Then let me say it clearer, Ruth said. The hero is proof of the limits of the king's power, a failure in the king's purported control of the timeline. If the king could have stopped the hero, he would have. Instead, he can only conceal him from us. How's that for blasphemy? As Aaron's face lost all colour, Joan had a strange feeling of almost knowing something. Like a word on the tip of her tongue, or like a dream that she couldn't quite remember. No, she said. The king created this timeline. He used something to change the original timeline. That was true. She didn't understand why she was so sure, but she was. And at the same time, she felt unsettled. Why was the court concealing Nick's actions? And if the court knew about Nick, why hadn't they already stopped him? We have to do something, she said. I know there are things we don't understand about this, but if Nick gets to the court before we do, if he changes the timeline, he's going to end us all. Joan, Aaron looked helpless. No, Joan said. No. She didn't want to talk about anything but a plan, because, Nick aside, they had to get to the monster court. She needed that device that could change the timeline. It was the only way to bring back Gran and Aunt Ada and Uncle Gus and Bertie. She needed it to undo what Nick had done. We can't get there before he does, Aaron said. We can't get there at all. The court sits outside time. It's inaccessible. Nick took the only way in, the necklace. There must be another way, Joan said. There isn't, Ruth said. There must be, Joan said. She needed to think. Instead, she found herself helplessly remembering how Nick had slipped the necklace from under her shirt, how he'd looked at her. She tried to steady her breath. She didn't want to cry again. She remembered how his knuckles had brushed her throat as he'd worked the clasp from her neck. The necklace. A vague memory came to her. Ying Liu hadn't been the first person interested in the necklace. Someone else had asked about it first. When I first arrived in the 90s, she said slowly, someone at the market offered me money for Gran's necklace. So, Aaron said, those stall owners buy and sell all kinds of junk. But it wasn't junk, was it? Joan said. It was a key to the monster court. Joan remembered the gleam of interest in the man's eyes. Go on, he'd said. Name a price. If he buys stuff like that, she said, then maybe he sells stuff like that too. If he does, then he's mixed up in some dangerous things and we should stay away from him, Aaron said. If there's even a chance. Joan. Aaron sounded helpless and scared. The king's power is absolute. We can't just... He shook his head. He'd thought the term true timeline was blasphemous. Joan couldn't imagine how he must be feeling about going against the king more directly. You don't have to do this, she said to him. He didn't have to be part of this at all. I'll go down there and find the stall. But when she reached for the door, she found that Aaron and Ruth were following her. Joan pushed through the market. The court guards who'd raided earlier were gone, but they'd left behind an atmosphere of discontent and fear. One stall owner was crying as Joan passed her. The man who had stood at the stall with her earlier was nowhere to be seen. What do you remember of this guy? Aaron asked Joan as they walked through what Joan now recognised as the 21st century section of the market. There were clothes here that could have been from her own wardrobe at home. I think he was a Hathaway, Joan said. He'd had their muscular build. Aaron grimaced. You don't like that family, Joan said. Aaron had been annoyed by the loud Hathaways at the inn. They're thugs, Aaron said. The man wasn't at his stall. His card table was bare. Joan thought about the crying woman earlier. She turned to the seller at the next table. A woman with a bob of grey hair and a youthful face. Excuse me, Joan said. Yesterday, there was a man here selling phones. She hesitated, not sure how to ask if he'd been caught in the raid. To her relief, the woman pointed to the far end of the market. Down the back. The back of the market was dingy and cold. There didn't seem to be a particular time associated with it. Some tables were selling fresh eels and fish on ice. Other tables had nothing on them at all. Muscular men and women watched Joan as she passed. All Hathaways, she thought. There were animals here too, dogs mostly, but Joan glimpsed some cats and an animal that looked more fox than dog. I've never seen a dog like that, she whispered to Ruth. Ruth glanced over. It's not from this time. We can take animals with us when we travel. We can take small objects, Aaron said, which made sense. They'd arrived in this time with the clothes they'd been wearing. But only the Hathaway family can travel with animals, he went on. Most of them travel with a familiar. A familiar? It was a word Joan associated with witches. You mean a pet? Yes, a pet. The most useless family power in London. Aaron's tone was contemptuous. He kept his voice very low, though, as if he didn't dare insult the Hathaways within their hearing. The man who'd bought Joan's phone was at the very back of the market, where it ended in a smoke-blackened brick wall. From here, the rest of the market was just the curtained backs of stalls. Cardboard boxes lay about, discarded. There was a smell of old cabbage leaves and fish. The man sat at an empty card table, asleep, his squashed face snoozing against the dirty brick wall. A tiny bulldog snored at his feet. The man was a little older than 20, broad-shouldered and hulking. Sprawled out, he barely fit into the folding chair. Him, Ruth said to Joan. She groaned. Tell me Tom Hathaway isn't your guy. The man's arms were crossed in sleep. There was a tattoo around one bulging bicep. Culled lines formed a two-headed dog, each head meeting to growl at the other. "You know him?" Joan asked. Ruth grimaced. "Everyone at the Ravencroft Market knows Tom Hathaway. He used to be a court guard. Got sacked. Now he's a washed-up drunk who buys and sells phones." "Fantastic," Aaron said. Joan took a step closer. "Tom," she called. The man and dog continued to sleep. "Tom Hathaway?" Joan said louder. The man sniffed and twitched. "Can we talk to you?" Tom smacked his lips, but he didn't open his eyes.
"Get me a drink, love."
Ruth looked at Joan, and Joan mouthed back, "From where?" Aaron rolled his eyes. He bent down and grabbed a half-drunk beer bottle from under Tom's own card table. He plonked it down. Tom's eyes opened at the sound. He fumbled for the bottle and then swallowed down the remnants of the beer in one big gulp. "Tom," Joan said, "we want to buy something from you."
"Get me a drink, love."
"I think he's broken," Aaron said dryly. "When you pull the string, he only says one thing." "I think he needs a coffee," Joan said. The bulldog was awake now, sniffing at Joan's shoe. She bent to stroke its soft head. It was very small for a bulldog, but clearly well cared for, sleek brown and white fur and a solid build. Better cared for than Tom himself, who had the crooked nose of a fighter and was barely conscious in the early afternoon. "Tom, do you remember me?" Joan said. "You offered to buy my necklace." Tom peered at her through cracked eyelids. He saw her bare neck.
"You sold it to someone else?"
Not exactly, Joan said.
"Do you know where I could get another one?"
Aaron returned from somewhere with a paper cup of water. Tom took it eagerly and gulped. Then he wrinkled his nose.
"Oh, what's this?" he complained.
He offered his dog the rest of the water. It huffed and then struggled to its feet. Tom tilted the cup so that it could lap inside. "That necklace," Joan started again.
"Look,"
Tom interrupted.
"You want to buy a phone?"
Joan blinked. "No."
"You want to sell a phone?"
"No."
"Then fuck off."
"But the necklace, I know what it was," Tom said.
"Saw one once at the court, but you're not going to find one in any bloody market."
Joan deflated. She'd hoped he'd recognize the necklace because he'd seen ones like it here, but it seemed he'd only recognized it from his past life at the court itself.
Aaron realized it too.
"He's just an opportunist," he said to Joan. Tom's expression was blearily blank in response. Aaron clarified, sneering.
"You took a chance when you saw it. You offered to buy it and hoped she didn't know what it was."
Tom shrugged.
"Yeah."
"Let's go," Aaron said to Joan. He'd been surveying Tom and the dog, hand in his pocket like a landlord inspecting substandard property. Now he turned to leave. Joan put a hand on Aaron's arm.
"Wait," she said.
"Wait." They couldn't just walk away. Their family's lives were at stake. Every monster's life was at stake, their own included. They had to get into the court.
"My cousin tells me that you're a court guard," she said to Tom. "So?" Aaron said to Joan. "She also said he was fired."
He looked disdainfully down at Tom, at the empty beer bottles clinking under his table.
"Can't imagine why."
"We need to get in," Joan said to Tom. From Ruth's gasp and Aaron's alarmed look, Joan realized she shouldn't have said it so bluntly, but she kept picturing Nick already at the court. They couldn't let him get to that device. Tom's face was still bleary. Ruth and Aaron's alarm hadn't touched him.
"You want me to get you into the monster court?" he said.
"Can you do it?" Joan said. Her body felt tight with tension.
"Why do you want to get in?"
"None of your business," Aaron interjected. Tom regarded Aaron. You're an Oliver, aren't you?
Aaron didn't reply. Tom scratched at the crook of his jaw.
Could spot one of you anywhere. Nose in the air like you can't stand the smell of the rest of us.
Can you get us in or not? Joan said.
Tom closed his eyes deliberately. No, he said, flat and final.
Excellent find, Aaron said to Joan. He didn't bother to keep his voice down.
Really, top shelf.
But Joan wasn't ready to give up yet. She thought she was starting to get a read on Tom. You haven't even heard what's in it for you, she said to him.
Joan, Aaron said, let's just go.
Joan ignored him. She waited for Tom's eyes to crack open. We're going to steal from the court.
Joan,
Ruth said, and Aaron swore.
You are so fucking reckless, Aaron said.
But Tom's eyes were open properly now. A flicker of interest kindled. Joan was relieved. She'd read him right, and so had Aaron. Tom was an opportunist.
You want in? Joan said. Oh, for fuck's sake, Aaron said.
You're not an Oliver,
Tom said slowly to Joan.
We're Hunts, Ruth said.
Hunts? Tom rested his head against the wall, visibly relaxing. He looked intrigued. It was the opposite of how most people in the monster world reacted to the name Hunt. Tom retrieved a half-eaten sandwich from under the table that the dog had somehow missed. To Aaron's obvious disgust, Tom took a big bite.
What are thieves doing with an Oliver? He asked with his mouth full.
He owes her, Ruth said. She saved his life. Tom took another bite.
And she's making him steal from the court.
His bleary eyes brightened.
Making an Oliver break his vows to the king. Guess it's true what they say, huh?
He said to Aaron, mouth still full.
Never get into debt to a Hunt. They'll screw you sore.
What charming advice, Aaron said. Tom leaned back against the wall, chewing. He seemed to be enjoying watching Aaron squirm.
I've heard that Hunts can steal anything from anyone.
Joan nodded. But there were things at the court that you wanted when you worked there. He was probably pretty annoyed that he had been fired too.
Tom took his time finishing the sandwich. I might be interested, he said finally.
Really? Joan said. She breathed out, relieved.
Tom seemed to come to a decision. He held out a big hand for Joan to shake. Yeah.
Okay. Joan took his hand. It was nearly double the size of her own.
Okay. Why are you shaking his hand as if you've made a bargain? Aaron said to Joan incredulously. You haven't made a bargain. You haven't even agreed on a price. Oh, don't worry, sunshine, Tom said to him. I'll open the big door. As long as your little thieves open the other doors, we'll be square.
Oh, I see, Aaron said a little faintly.
The Hunts will steal what they want, you'll steal what you want, and I'll just continue to live my best life.
Be ready in 2 nights' time, Tom added.
2 nights, Joan said. She'd been barreling through the conversation, her only concern to get into the court before Nick. Now, though, she felt a wave of unease.
That's when the gate opened, Tom said.
The gate, Joan said. Tom nodded. There's going to be a gala at the court. Lucky you, huh? Last time the gate opened was centuries ago, and it won't open again for another century. It's like it's opening just for you.
Lucky us, Joan heard herself say. But all she could think about was how she and Aaron weren't even supposed to be in this time. They'd overshot.
Lucky. It didn't feel like luck. With that new monster sense in the back of her head, Joan could feel the timeline stirring, as if it had when she'd watched those envelopes fall. And she couldn't have said why, but the unease bloomed into foreboding. Back at the flat, Aaron was furious. We're not doing this, he said. They'd left Tom at the market, already half asleep again. This is ridiculous. This is not a plan.
Well, not yet, Ruth said.
But I think he could get us in. He was a court guard, and if we have a way in, then we have the start of a plan.
Were we looking at the same man?
He could barely hold his head up.
Aaron's voice was shaking. Do you have any idea what the court will do to us if they catch us? And they will, if we have to rely on that fool.
We'll be careful, Joan said.
Look, Ruth said to Aaron, if we're wrong about Tom, if we're caught at the gate, then we'll get arrested. So what? We'll just make up some lie about gate crashing the party.
Arrested, Aaron said.
Have you ever actually met a member of the Monster Court? Have you come face to face with one of the Curia Monstrorum?
No, Ruth admitted.
I've seen court guards.
Aaron looked at her with a bleak expression Joan had never seen on his face before.
One of them came for my cousin once, he said.
You actually saw a member of the Monster Court? Ruth sounded disbelieving. One of the Curia Monstrorum. Which one?
Conrad, Aaron said.
He answered the question in Joan's expression.
We call him the King's Reach. He's the King's authority in this time. He is responsible for enforcing the law 2 centuries into the future and 3 centuries behind.
Kind of like a policeman, Joan said.
Aaron's face went pinched. Not really like that, no.
Conrad came.
In person? Ruth asked. She still sounded disbelieving. For a moment, it seemed like Aaron was going to leave it at that, but then he set his jaw.
I was there. I was at school with my cousin Kit when Conrad came.
Joan glanced at Ruth. Her posture was still skeptical, but Joan could tell she wanted to know more.
They say that Conrad was a nightingale once, Aaron said. When he ascended to the court, he revoked all ties to his family. His loyalty is only to the king now, but he still has the nightingale power. He can steal life from monsters.
His tone was becoming more subdued.
And they say he can do other things. They say he can force people to travel with him.
He forced your cousin to travel with him? Joan asked Aaron. Aaron didn't seem to hear her. His attention was on something inside his own head. Kit and I were walking back to our dorm room. When we turned the corner, Conrad was waiting for us. Aaron swiped a hand over his mouth. He told us to follow him outside. He took us to the pond down by the football field. Well, they called it a pond, but it's more like a lake. I didn't go down there much. People used to say it was haunted.
Aaron's mouth twisted. Conrad just stood there, looking at us. Then he said,
Do you know why I'm here?
He was so casual. He said, Someone's been taking time at this school. Students who attend are 18% more likely to die before the age of 75 than the general population. He said that one day, that anomaly would draw the attention of human authorities. He said that the king didn't tolerate mistakes like that.
What did he do? Joan asked, hushed.
He just... Aaron's hands curled into fists. He told me to go to my room. I went. I stayed up all night, but Kit didn't come back. The police dredged the pond for him in the end, because he...
His voice cracked, finally.
See, back in the 60s, they'd found a boy's body in that pond. They thought maybe something like that had happened again.
Oh, Ruth said, soft. Aaron's hands uncurled and curled again.
We must have heard those stupid ghost stories 100 times.
You just walked back to your room, Joan blurted. You didn't try to help your cousin or anything.
Anger flashed over Aaron's face.
What do you know about going up against the court? There was a horrible rawness in his voice, a tone that Joan didn't fully understand. Okay, Ruth said placatingly. Okay. Shit. Aaron thumbed the corner of his eye. We can't do this. We don't have a plan. We're not trained to fight. We have nothing. We're going to plan this, Joan said. We don't even know what we're looking for. We have no idea what this device looks like. We don't know where it will be. We wouldn't even know if we saw it. You're right, Joan said. Okay, you're right. You're right. And he was right. They couldn't plan this knowing as little as they did. They needed more information. Joan knew what she had to do. The innkeeper was alone when Joan arrived at the inn. It was very late. Joan had left Aaron and Ruth asleep at the flat. Only the lights of the main dining room were still on. The wall of stained glass was dull without the backdrop of daylight. The cauldron of stew bubbled softly over the low burning hearth. "Was wondering when you'd come back," the innkeeper said. He was sitting by the hearth reading a book. As Joan got closer, she saw that it was in a language with a non-Roman alphabet. "Have you found her?" she said. The innkeeper dug into his pocket and retrieved a folded piece of paper, but he didn't give it to her. "Dorothy Hunt is not a good person," he said. "I don't know what your business is with her, but you want my advice? Put this in the fire." Joan held out her hand for it. Without her phone, Joan had to ask for directions and then more directions just to get to Soho. By the time she got to the address, the night was cold and black. She stood outside the door, feeling a wave of déjà vu. Aaron wasn't with her this time, but there was a plaque beside the black door. A sea serpent engulfing a sailing ship. This was a monster place. The door opened onto a short, dark corridor with soft lights along the floor. It reminded Joan of walking up the aisle of an airplane. At the end, there was a room just a little wider than the corridor, lit with golden chandeliers the colour of candlelight. A gleaming wooden bar ran the length of the room. Joan stood there, frozen. There she was, Gran, sitting alone at the bar, drinking. She couldn't have been more than 25 years old. Dressed for the 90s in black ankle boots and a black gauzy dress with a high Peter Pan collar. Joan had expected her to be young, but not quite this young. Joan was reminded again that monsters were time travellers. She imagined them, suddenly, living a few months in this year, a few months in that one, skipping back and forth between decades at whim. She wondered if she'd ever get her head around all this. Gran was beautiful young, a different beautiful from her older self. Her cheekbones were still sharp. She had Ruth's hair, lustrous dark curls. Her eyes were the same luminous green as in Joan's time. And she was alive. She was alive and she was here. "I fucking hate this song," Gran said to the bartender conversationally. It was "Wind Beneath My Wings." Gran and Aunt Ada had argued about it once. They'd all been at a funeral for a distant cousin of Gran's. "You don't even know this song," Aunt Ada had hissed to Gran. "I know bullshit when I hear it," Gran had hissed back. The bartender lifted his head and saw Joan. "Out," he said. "No kids in here."
"I just want to talk," Joan said. "To her. I just want to talk to... Dorothy." She stumbled over Gran's name, unused to saying it.
"I'm not selling you anything," the bartender said.
"I'm not buying," Joan said. "5 minutes, please."
The bartender looked over at Gran, and Gran nodded slightly. 5 minutes, the bartender said. "I'm setting a timer." Joan took a deep breath and sat on the bar stool next to Gran's. She didn't know where to start. Gran lifted her glass, and Joan saw that her ring finger was bare. Joan had never seen her without her ruby wedding ring.
I don't know you, Gran said, with her usual gruff impatience. What do you want?
I'm your granddaughter, Joan blurted.
Granddaughter? Gran said, but her sharp gaze flicked over to Joan and then stayed.
I look more like my dad.
What's your name?
Joan. Joan Chang Hunt.
Chang? That's not a monster name.
Gran gulped down her drink.
So, Maureen's been messing around with humans. Christ.
Joan was shocked. Gran had never said anything like that to her before. Gran had always gotten along with Dad.
You have something to tell me, Gran said. That's why you're here. Just say it.
And that was where Gran's harshness was coming from, Joan realized. Gran had known the moment that Joan had said granddaughter that something bad was coming. The memory of Gran's agonized breaths returned to Joan in a rush, the slow, pained rise and fall of her chest under Joan's hands.
Just say it, Gran said.
You... 2 days ago, 30 years from now, you died. You were killed. Joan's voice shook. The human hero isn't just a myth, Gran. He's real.
He came and killed our family.
He killed... God. He killed so many people.
Some of the harshness left Gran's face as Joan talked. Joan kept expecting the timeline to unravel as she told Gran the place and the time. But... just like with the post office, Joan could feel the timeline resisting. Do you believe me? She said to Gran. Please believe me.
I believe you, Gran said, and Joan felt her chest loosen. She'd been tenser than she'd known.
Gran called over the bartender to refill her glass. Joan waited for him to leave again and then lowered her voice.
Just before you died, you gave me a necklace, she said. A key to the monster court. I think you wanted me to find a device that the king once used to change the timeline, to stop the massacre and save our family. But I don't know how to find it, Gran.
The Transformatio, Gran said. That's a myth.
A lot of myths seem to be proving true lately, Joan said. Gran's mouth turned downward. She always looked like that when she was thinking. When she was angry, she tended to look amused. When she was looking at a mark, her expression went blank. I always heard that the king keeps his treasures in the royal archive, Gran said. She tilted her head, and a trick of the light made her familiar green eyes seem cool, almost cold. Joan hadn't expected Gran to be so forthcoming. The older version of her was much cagier. She'd have asked Joan a lot more questions before telling her anything at all. Perhaps that wariness had come to her in older age.
Did I tell you anything else? Gran said. Joan, wasn't it?
Joan started to shake her head and then realized there was something else. She hadn't been deliberately withholding it. She'd archived it, hardly let herself think about it. Keeping an eye on the bartender, Joan whispered to Gran what Gran had whispered to her.
Just before you died, you told me that someday soon I'd come into a power. Not the Hunt power, but another. It was the last thing you said. You told me not to trust anyone with the knowledge of it. And I haven't, I swear, you're the only one I've told.
Gran's expression went blank.
A power.
She glanced up and Joan realized, startled, that the bartender was standing a few paces away. He hadn't been there a second ago. He'd been drying glasses at the other end of the bar.
What kind of power? Gran said.
I don't know, Joan whispered. I haven't seen any sign of it yet.
Hmm, Gran said. Her expression was still blank.
She made two scratching motions with her forefinger. It was one of their family's signals, the signal to fetch someone. But fetch who? It was usually accompanied by a name signal, three fingers up for Ruth, a thumb and forefinger crossed for Aunt Ada, forefinger and thumb in a J for Joan. Who did she want Joan to fetch? Gran made the name signal with her left hand, but not one Joan had ever seen before. Her hand was curled, thumb at an angle. C? G? It wasn't until the bartender put down his cloth and said, "Excuse me," that Joan realized the signal hadn't been intended for her at all. Gran didn't realize Joan had understood it. She didn't seem to know that one day she'd teach it to Joan. Gran's green eyes were narrow and speculative now. She was looking at Joan like she was valuable, but not like a person was valuable. Like something that could be sold for a very high price. "You can't trust anyone with the knowledge of it," Gran had said. Joan's chest felt painfully tight. "Is there a toilet down there?" Joan pointed in the wrong direction, deeper into the bar, hoping that would be less suspicious. She knew that the bathroom was near the front door. She'd passed it on the way in.
"Back the way you came," Gran said.
"If you need to run, always imply that you'll return." Gran had taught Joan that.
"You won't go, will you?" Joan said. "You'll be here when I get back."
"Haven't finished my drink, have I?" Gran said.
Joan made herself linger. Even though all she wanted to do was to get out of this room, get away from this version of Gran who wasn't her Gran, who'd looked at Joan like she didn't mean anything to her, who'd told the bartender to fetch someone. Joan turned slowly. Putting her back to this Gran made her skin crawl. She walked to the corridor and turned the corner. She walked past the toilets and then pushed open the door out onto the street. And then she ran. She looked back once at the end of the laneway. The bartender was standing in the doorway staring after her. Joan ran harder. She didn't look back again. Gran had warned Joan not to trust anyone. It just hadn't occurred to Joan that she'd been including herself. As Joan ran, she started to sob as she hadn't since Gran had died. Some part of her had believed that everything would be okay when she found Gran again. She believed that Gran would take over and stop Nick herself. But the woman back there hadn't been Gran. Joan's Gran was dead. She was really dead. She'd died 2 days ago and Joan hadn't been able to stop it. Aaron was awake when Joan got back. He was sitting outside the flat, looking out onto the empty market below. It was very late by then. The tables were tarped, the food stalls shuttered.
"Where did you go?" he whispered to Joan.
"I found out what we needed to know," Joan said. "The king's treasures are kept in a place called the Royal Archive. The device is called the Transformatio. We need to include that in our research, find out if there are any physical descriptions in the myths." Joan waited for Aaron to push back. "It's still too dangerous. Even if we get into the court, how are we going to get into the archive?" But there was a different kind of frown on his face now.
"Where did you go?" he said again, softer. "Joan, are you all right?"
"Course I'm all right." Joan was glad it was too dark for him to see her face. "Come on," she said. She held out her hand to help him up. "There's a lot to do," she said. And in 2 nights' time, they'd save their families. They'd save everyone. Chapter 15. 2 nights later, Joan paced the market flat, waiting for Aaron and Ruth to finish getting ready. Aaron had styled them all. He'd found Ruth a sparkling platinum dress and Joan a forest green gown with a plunging back.
The heavy drape of it brushed Joan's legs as she paced. Aaron emerged first, from behind the bookshelf partition, hand in his pocket. A young James Bond. His suit was the same pale grey as his eyes. Joan tried not to stare. He always turned strangers' heads, but this sophisticated look had made him mesmerising. It was hard to look away. He doesn't fit here, Joan thought, not for the first time. He belonged at a glamorous estate, not in this little studio flat above a market. Nervous, he said, and Joan realised with a strange feeling that he'd been watching her too, that his gaze had sought her as he'd entered the living area. She made an effort to stop pacing. The gold light of sunset had tinted the stained glass windows, making the whole room glow, a low-burning hearth. She was nervous. Yes, she admitted, and then wondered when she'd started to trust Aaron enough to be that open with him. Feels so close, she explained. Like maybe we'll have our families back tonight. Maybe. Aaron's gaze hadn't left hers. For a moment, Joan thought he was going to say something more, but he seemed to change his mind. He scooped up two shopping bags that had been resting by the bookshelf and brought them over to her. More clothes, Joan said. Finishing touches, Aaron said. He took out a midnight blue velvet box. Inside, there was a long string of pearls, knotted at the centre with diamonds. Joan stared at him. Verisimilitude, he said. May I? Were the pearls real? Were the diamonds? Surely not. Verisimilitude. She turned. She felt rather than heard him step closer, a change in temperature. She bunched her hair, tucked it over one shoulder and ducked her head. To her surprise, he draped the long, heavy line of the necklace down her back rather than her front. She shivered as each pearl hit her skin, a splash of icy water. The pearls warmed quickly, though. She turned to find Aaron standing closer than she'd expected. She thought he'd step back, but he stayed there, in her space. His eyes seemed darker than they had a few moments ago. Joan's heart stuttered strangely. So what do you think? She said. She tried to make it light, but they were so close that her voice came out unexpectedly intimate. Will we pass for important people? When Aaron spoke, it was just as intimately, with no sign of his usual snide tone. You're important, he said, his grey eyes very serious. I know you want your family back, but your life matters too. Joan opened her mouth to protest, and he shook his head slightly. Just please be careful tonight. The court is a dangerous place. Joan felt a stab of guilt then. She'd dragged Aaron to this point. From the beginning, all he'd wanted was to lie low, to be safe. You don't have to do this, she said, just as serious as he was. You keep saying you owe me, but you don't. We both know that debt has been paid. Was there some special monster wording for this? You're released, she tried. I release you. Joan. There was something complicated in his expression, something Joan couldn't decipher. He sighed and took a shoebox from another of the bags. He passed it to her. Inside, there was a pair of soft black flats. In case we have to run, he said. They got a cab to Victoria Embankment. Tom had told them that the gate would open at midnight near Whitehall Palace. Joan had been confused. Whitehall Palace had burned down 300 years ago. It's just the physical location, Aaron had explained. It's hard to keep track of what buildings are around when. If monsters say Newgate Prison,
We just mean where it once stood.
Now, as they walked up Horse Guards Avenue, Joan's chest felt tight. Even in daylight, there was something skeletal about Whitehall's bleached buildings. Tonight, it felt like walking into the streets of the dead. I hate Myers, Aaron said as they walked. They give me the creeps.
Myers are places where you can't travel, Ruth explained to Joan. This one stretches from Westminster Abbey to Leicester Square. You can't travel anywhere, in or out, while you're here.
They'd scouted earlier to find a building recess with a view of the banqueting house, the only part of Whitehall Palace still standing. The spot wasn't perfect. They were only shielded from the street by a railing, but as Joan settled into place beside Aaron, the darkness enveloped them. Down the road, clumps of tourists milled around the mounted sentries of the Horse Guards building, but the street was otherwise quiet. Joan kept track of the time by counting Big Ben's strikes. 10 o'clock went by, then 11 o'clock. The temperature dropped. Long after 11, there was still no sign of a gate or of guests for the court gala. The only warm part of Joan's body was her arm, where it was pressed against Aaron's. She couldn't stop shivering. He must have been cold, too. There was some room between him and the rail, but he hadn't moved from Joan's side.
Maybe Tom got the time wrong, Joan whispered. Maybe he's a drunken fool who hasn't been a guard in years, Aaron whispered back.
Joan opened her mouth to answer, and then stopped. Someone was emerging from the direction of Charing Cross. She nudged Aaron. Ruth was already looking. The moon was gibbous, but offered little light. Only the person's silhouette was visible. Their gait as they passed was eerie, slow and gliding. Joan found herself holding her breath. New footsteps made them all turn again toward Parliament. Two more people were approaching. Men in Victorian top hats, and still more people from Horse Guards Avenue. Big Ben began to sound. It was midnight. The arrivals were all on foot. Some silhouettes were familiar, some alien, clothes from the distant past or the future. Monsters. Aaron's breath was coming shorter now. He sounded as nervous as Joan felt. She could just see his face, pale grey in the dark. On Big Ben's last strike, the world seemed to still. The sounds of London ceased. No cars, no rush of water from the Thames, no insects in the air. Joan craned to look at the Horse Guards. They were sitting on their horses, still as ever. Terrified? Or had they been frozen in time? Look, Aaron breathed. He nodded at the junction between Horse Guards Avenue and Whitehall. At first, Joan wasn't sure if she was making patterns out of nothing, like seeing shapes and clouds, but something seemed to be changing in the junction. Shadows were shifting like smoke. What is it? Ruth whispered. Joan had seen it before, in paintings of old London. It's the gate, she said. It's the Whitehall Palace gate. The shadows solidified into a huge arch straddling Horse Guards Avenue. It was the arch alone, without the palace walls, the bare brick bones of it. Joan stared. Inside the arch, the stars were unaligned with the sky outside. Inside, the moon was full, and framed like a picture was Whitehall Palace, beautiful and whole, before the fire. A lone figure came into view on the wrong side of the gate. The figure stepped through, and a male voice rang out, theatrical and baritone. Welcome to the Monster Court. A murmur of excitement ran through the crowd.
The road in front of the arch was full of people now, and more were arriving. The atmosphere was giddy in pockets, solemn in others. But above all, a strange tension hung over everything. Joan could feel why. Some sixth sense inside her, the monster sense, could feel the timeline straining fruitlessly against this unnatural beast. Whitehall Palace, out of its time.
"I've never seen anything like this," Ruth whispered. "I always heard that the king had power, but seeing it..."
Joan scanned the crowd. Aaron knew who she was looking for. "Those guards aren't moving," he whispered. "If the hero is here, he's frozen like the other humans. There's some kind of suspension over everything but monsters. I've never seen power like this either."
"This is the advantage that we need," Joan whispered back. "If Nick can't get in, even with the key, we'll get the device, not him. Then we'll just have to figure out how to use it."
"One thing at a time," Aaron said. "We're not in yet." He nodded at the gate, where guards were verifying people's identities before allowing them through. Tom had explained how the gate identification would work. "There'll be a guest list at the door," he'd said.
"And you can get us on the guest list?" Joan had asked.
"No," Tom had said, as if that were a ridiculous thought. "The guards have a book of personal marks. That's the guest list. Guests find their mark in the list and then stamp their chop next to it to prove their identity. But I know for a fact that the guard who checks the marks gets lazy late in the night. So just get into the line late and then find a mark that's a near match to yours."
"And if we can't find a near match," Aaron said.
"Then you'll get found out," Tom said. "He's lazy, not an idiot." That had presented a problem. Joan didn't have a chop, and the other two couldn't leave a record of their real marks at the gate. Tom had taken them down to a marina where narrow boats and barges with peeling paint bobbed up and down on brown water. His little bulldog, Frankie, had toddled behind him. When her stubby legs had struggled with the wharf steps, Tom had leaned down and bundled her under one arm.
"The Hathaways live on the canals and the river," Ruth had whispered to Joan. "This is their territory."
Muscular men and women had eyed them from boat decks and from chairs set up along the wharf. There'd been a homespun quality to the boats. Most had obvious repairs. They'd all had the same symbol, painted on the cabin or as the weather vane, a two-headed hound, growling and black. Real animals had been everywhere too, lounging on decks and running underfoot. Dogs, birds, cats. Tom had climbed down into a boat at the end of the wharf, Frankie still under his arm. He'd returned with a tray full of chops, the figurines dull and dirty. "Tell me you're not a grave robber," Aaron had said.
"Don't be daft," Tom had said. "They came out of the river. Everything washes up on the foreshore, even monster chops."
He held out the tray. "Go on, pick." Aaron had gone first. He'd sorted through all the chops, dismissive until he'd finally found a bronze mermaid figurine.
"Not much of a disguise," Ruth had said.
"I'm clearly an Oliver," Aaron had said. "No one would believe anything less." Ruth had gone next. She'd chosen a Patel family chop, a white horse, its chipped enamel showing glimpses of the bronze beneath. Joan had picked out a figurine that reminded her of the sea serpent images beside monster doors.
"A Dragonara serpent," Ruth had said.
Joan had turned it over. The underside had been etched with a name, Leah Portelli. Joan gripped her figurine now as she waited in the queue. The gate arched behind the guards, creating a dark passage between this world and the next. Through the gap, Whitehall Palace gleamed, bone white as the banqueting house. Aaron stepped up to the guard.
"Henry Oliver,"
he said.
The Book of Marks sat open on a pedestal like a guest book at a wedding. The guard turned the pages with a white-gloved hand. Joan glimpsed caged bird stamps for pages and pages, and then the Oliver Mermaids. Aaron ran a finger down the page, one hand in his pocket as if he were bored by the ritual. Then he reached for the golden ink pad and stamped his seal beside one of the marks. The guard glanced down at the book. Joan held her breath. Now, at the crucial moment, the whole plan seemed stupid. It relied too much on one man's poor judgment and on luck. The stamps would have to look reasonably similar.
Pleasant evening, Aaron commented to the guard.
The dates on both sides were chosen for the occasion, the guard said.
He nodded at Aaron.
Welcome to the Monster Court, he waved Aaron through.
Joan breathed out in relief. Ruth was waved through next. And then it was Joan's turn. She took her place in front of the guard. He was wearing a dark blue uniform with gold braid. This close, she could see that his gold buttons were etched with winged lions. She'd seen the same creature on Monster Currency, and again on the guard's pins at the market. The symbol of the Monster Court. The guard himself was just as Tom had described him. Curly blonde hair under the braided guard's hat, and heavy-lidded eyes already dull with boredom. The guard had barely glanced at Ruth's mark, but Joan's hand still shook as she reached for the book. She'd tried to memorize the features of Leopardelli's chop. The sea serpent, the exact pattern of the rippling waves around it. The number of olive leaves and the border wreath. The man held up a hand to stop her.
Please wait, he said. We're changing guards.
What? Joan whispered. Her mouth was so dry, the sound hardly came out.
Do you have any idea what the court will do to us if they catch us? Aaron had said.
On the other side of the gate, Aaron and Ruth were waiting. They'd seen the guard speak, but apparently hadn't been able to hear any words. As the lazy guard stepped away, Aaron's eyes widened in alarm. Joan's heart thudded as a new guard made her way through the gate. She had a neat blonde bun and hard eyes. She took her place by the book and then nodded at Joan.
Please find your mark, she said.
Go. Joan willed Aaron and Ruth. Go. But they just stood there, staring at her. Joan's heart sped up even more. If she was caught, they'd be caught too. They'd made it too obvious that the three of them were together. The new guard looked Joan up and down.
Please find your mark, she said again, with more impatience.
Portelli, Joan managed. The guard turned the pages from the horses of the Patels until she reached the pages with the Portelli's dragon-like sea serpent. Joan swallowed. She could see the differences at a glance. And she wasn't even an expert at looking for them. She wet her dry lips and then pressed her stamp to the golden ink pad. That